Hi, I'm Alison. Welcome to Dream Chasers Adventures in Happiness, where my band of superhero guests and I share with you tales of daring do, life-changing journeys towards living our best lives. If you're after an injection of inspiration and ideas to live the life that you want and deserve, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Hi there, and welcome to the show where we serve up conversation, concepts, and belief that it is entirely possible to create what you crave. If there's something stopping you from pursuing happiness, whatever that looks like to you from a career or lifestyle point of view, the stories and insights covered here are designed to help. Now today, I've got an awesome guest for you, all around the subject of happiness at work. I'm really excited about having him on the show. Matt Phelan is the co-founder and co-CEO of a company called the Happiness Index. He's also founded the Happiness and Humans Community to help build a future of work that's more human. Hallelujah to that. And he hosts the Happiness and Humans podcast and is the author of Freedom to Be Happy and the Happiness Index books. Now, a couple of years ago, Matt also gave a TEDx talk where he presented 12 million data points in happiness from 1 million people in over 100 countries. So what this man does not know about happiness, particularly in a work context, probably isn't worth knowing. So today we're going to dig into what the Happiness Index is all about. We're going to understand the latest learnings, or what the latest learnings are around happiness and engagement and what really drives us in those areas. We're going to talk about something called the super happiness suit. And we're going to distinguish whether happiness at work is different from happiness in our personal lives. You know, do we have separate drivers for those areas of our lives, or are there strong commonalities? This is such a cool topic. So let's dive in. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me. And if my children were listening, they would definitely not describe me as awesome. And in terms of what there isn't to know about happiness, we're still learning so much. Like, I think we're up to about 37 million data points now. That TEDx talks was 12 million. But wow. I still think we've only uncovered about 1% of what there is to know. I think there is still a lot to learn. And we'll get onto some of that today, I think.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so just to give a bit of context for listeners, can you explain a bit about what the Happiness Index is and what it does?
Yeah, so there's three parts of the Happiness Index. The first part is the bit that people know us for and is way bigger than the actual company, which is we release data, research, and insight from our data set. So that's, like you've said, like I've done a TEDx on it. I've written a book called The Happiness Index. We release that out. And that creates this perception that we're this massive company, but we're actually not. we're a small organization. So there's the data and insight bit that drives our passion for what you call freedom to be human. And that we call that unlocking the secrets of workplace happiness. That's our vision. All right.
Okay.
But the way that most of we make our money, we have to pay bills, we have to pay our staff, all those normal business challenges we also have, is an employee engagement and happiness platform. So that's that measures how your employees think and feel. And then on top of that, we've built a range of services that we call Action, Thrive and Perform. Because there's basically challenges that you get with data. The first challenge is people don't know how their people feel. And then they get that data back, but then they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with the data. So we help them with that.
Yeah.
Even if you put an amazing action plan in place, which we have AI and our team that help people do that, even if you get the best action plan, if you get the best data, the best action plan, and then you put it out there, it still falls flat quite often on the front line. So your data could show you that you don't have an empathetic culture, or there's not a feedback culture in the organization, but you can't just send that as an action plan, say to everyone, I'll give better feedback. It just doesn't work. So, that happens. We laugh, but that does happen. So we have training programs that help people actually deliver the improvements in engagement and happiness. And then the final bit, which is probably the bit most in demand at the moment, which is how do you build a model that links your culture to performance? Because that's what everyone's been tasked with. Because you hear these like weird statements like, I want to have a good culture, but hit my numbers. So we always say you want to have a good culture and hit your numbers. Like they're not separate things. And we'll talk about some of that later.
Not mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, all right, fascinating. So before we dive into some more of the details, like, what's the latest? Let's kick off. Like, what's the latest research on career happiness generally?
Okay, so it's not good news for people my age, which is, and very sadly, I say that as a joke, but very sadly, it's not good news for the younger generation. So the traditional research of your career and life satisfaction, ironically, is like a smile. Mm. So the graph goes like a smile of like happiest at 18 and 65. But down where I am, where you might have a classic situation, and not everyone's in this same situation, but you may have young children and aging parents and a career that's, it's like most difficult because you might be in a senior position, but you're still learning how to be in a senior position. So all of that kind of combines into this U-shape.
Right.
Which I always say to people, you don't have to be a statistic. You can be 42 and happy. It's not saying you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just how it plots out on a on an average graph. However, probably the saddest, most recent research that's out shows that that U-shape is actually changing. And I'm not even going to try and come up with what the new shape is, but the younger generations, like the first 5, 6, 7 years in the workforce, are not as happy as they used to be. So these things are talked about quite regularly in popular society and in the world of work around the new generation. But I think there is a, think there is a serious issue there. And I think companies either have, they have two choices. They can either do something about it or they could ignore it.
Yeah.
Sadly, I think there are a lot of companies that are ignoring and just kind of, young people don't want to work hard these days. But I think you can go back as far as ancient Greece to find manuscripts of one generation saying that the next generation are not going to work very hard. They don't care. They're not motivated like us. You go back to any movie about the 60s, it's the same. What the generation that grew up in that were in the war, and they thought that their children were lazy and this kind of stuff. So there's a societal impact there, but you can't get away from it. The younger generation are feeling it at the moment. And I don't fit into the camp of people who think it's their fault or we should ignore it. I think there's some serious stuff going on. Get into it and we can fix it.
Yeah. Okay, fascinating. And also very concerning. So, you know, so we're still, I think we're around the same age probably. We're at the bottom of that curve that used to be a U curve, but now it's not even, there's not even a high point that's starting when you're kind of 18 to 24 or 5 or something. It's actually quite a dip. Okay, so I know we'll get into more of this, but so you guys measure employee engagement and happiness in the workplace. And I think, what's the difference? Because everybody's heard of employee engagement, because that typically, I think, is the measure that organisations use. But you're measuring the two things. So what's the difference between them?
So if you look at what employee engagement is and was coined, so employee engagement was coined by Bill Kahn in 1990. Recorded a great podcast with him. So if you go to the Happiness Index podcast, you can listen to me interviewing him. He always believed that when he invented or coined employee engagement, it also was always a reading of the emotional feeling of the workplace and the employees.
Right.
However, he believes that that's been lost in employee engagement. It's become a really serious business metric. So if you look at a lot of platforms, what they're actually measuring is employee net promoter score. So they say they're measuring engagement, but what they're actually measuring is employee net promoter score. And it's not to say ENPS is a bad measurement, but it's not engagement. It's not deep enough. It's not thorough enough. It's not universal enough. It's very Western, works very well in America. Mm-hmm. So we believe through our research and our science and our data that engagement is what your brain needs at work and happiness is what your heart needs. So our distinction is engagement is what you think about work and happiness is what you feel about work. And I would ask anyone, think about the differences by thinking about your own life. There are many relationships that you may have left in your own life where all your friends said, why are you leaving that job? Or why are you leaving your boyfriend? Or why are you leaving your girlfriend? That all these things that they think are important, tick, tick, tick. Oh, we've got all that. But deep down, you know that you need to leave that relationship. It could be your employer. It could be your partner. It could be a sibling that is not making you feel good. And you decide, okay, maybe we're not going to speak to each other anymore. All this kind of stuff. So It's just acknowledging the fact that employees actually feel and we're not robots. But we don't discount what the brain needs. The brain still needs things like clarity that are in our model and so on. So we say engagement is what the brain needs and happiness is what the heart needs.
Really interesting, right? So I love the distinction between the two. What's interesting to me is, so obviously you guys are engaging with businesses and business leaders to try and get them to take, I guess, the emotional side, like what they might deem the fluffy side, seriously. You know, how what argument do you use to get them to understand that actually the idea of increasing happiness as well as engagement at work is vital?
So you have to engage the finance team and the financial side of the business. So you have to start having conversations and to understand their business around what is the cost of losing an employee, or what is the cost of not having an employee, or what is the cost of someone that you've trained really well leaving because that they don't feel like they belong there. The cost of staff being off ill because of a stressful work environment. So you've got to start getting into the P&L and linking the data together. So going back to your belief point at the beginning, Alison, my estimate from the companies and organizations I've met is probably one third of CEOs just believe through either intuition or the way that they've been raised and become a leader themselves, they just believe that this is a good idea. So it's a relatively simple process when you meet those leaders. There's about one third that are very data driven. And if you can build that model with them, they can put that in, they can plug it in, and they can get behind it. Very rational people. I still think there's probably one third of people out there that just don't believe and don't think it belongs at work. And I don't think skepticism is a problem. I think it has a place in every walk of work and research. Like, you need skeptics to highlight important questions. However, we are a small company or small organization. So I focus my time on the one third that, if you can give the data, will understand and use it. So there's only so much time and everything you can do in life. So there's the one third that they come along, they say, we love what you do, they become clients, all this kind of stuff. They reap the benefits. But I spend my time with the one third in the middle, trying to help them see that the two are not separate.
They're not separate.
They're the same thing. But because of the way maybe someone was taught by their first manager, or the way that their brain works, they might not see it. But once you start to show them it, they realize that they're not differing. And once you show it with their data, because there's loads of external research like that shows that happier employees are more productive, they sell more, they're more creative. All these researchers out there, there's thousands of studies on it. But unless it becomes relatable to your business that you're in charge of, that one third is quite hard, because they'll go, yeah, no, look, I know that, Matt, but I'm not that type of company, or I'm not that's not the real world. So the research, external research by academics and everything's brilliant, but you need to be able to apply it to the business you're working
with. Apply it to their business.
They won't be able to get all the stakeholders on board.
So I remember listening, when I was listening to your TED talk, you gave two, I thought they were brilliant examples, and they were very different types of organisations. I think it was the NHS was one example you used, where you were linking, you know, unhappy staff to very different, you know, like tough outcomes. Mm-hmm. And then you gave an investor example. Could you just walk through those? Just to give people an idea about why this genuinely is important.
So Professor Jeremy Dawson, Sheffield University, they did, at the time, and probably still, is the largest single study into one workforce on employee happiness. And that was in the NHS. And what they found is, go and look up the research yourself and read it, I would recommend. But, and then also I've interviewed Jeremy on his study, so you can go to my podcast again on that one. Long story short, if two hospitals are exactly the same, they found that the hospitals with the unhappier staff have worse outcomes. But in the NHS, and the outcomes they're talking about, they're things like mortality rates and their patient outcomes. So long story short, if you had two hospitals exactly the same, the one with the unhappier staff is likely to have a higher death rate, which that's where when you get into the subject, starts to get fluffy. It starts to take out the fluffy bit, because people think this is fluffy. Suddenly you're talking about people dying. But then even if you show like the most data-driven CEO of a corporate business that, they go, well, we're not a hospital, are we? It's not, yeah. We don't need to worry about stuff like that. So you get, some people will read that study, they'll listen to Jeremy on the podcast and they'll be like, I'm in, I get this now.
Yeah.
But some people still won't be. And Professor Alex Edmonds took American stock market data, and long story short, again, he's on the podcast, he talks about his research, got another great book out at the moment. Look up his stuff, LSE, and what they showed is that organizations with listed organizations in America with happier staff outperform their peers on the stock market over, I think, 25 to 28 years. So it's not a short study. So there's a long study and a large study looking at very different things, but starting to paint the picture that happiness links to outcomes. But if you still those studies are quite macro, so but think about it in your own life. Think about going back to those relationships. Think about when you've been in a relationship where you're not feeling it. Ask yourself, honestly, are you giving your best or most to that relationship? And it doesn't have to be a work one. It could be any relationship. Yeah. And I think most people will reflect on that and think, no, it does. The way that I feel does impact the way that I perform. And you need both sides of it. You need the personal story, you need the macro study, and then you need to bring it into the middle of the actual company you're working with to make the magic happen. But it's still not easy. But that's what you need to line up to get these projects moving forward.
Okay. So they're really stark examples. It's amazing. So you have the largest body of data on what makes us happy at work. And I talked about, in the intro, I said that, you did a TED talk and it was titled 12 Million Lessons in Happiness. And it was based on feedback from 1 million people.
Yeah.
And I know that, and that was a number of years ago. Like, can you talk about or share from your research, like, what the top line findings are? Like, what does make us happy or unhappy at work?
So I'll talk about a little bit there and then I'll talk about where we are now. So we're on about 4 million employees now and about 37 million data points. There are some people that would argue there's larger data sets. We would say it's the deepest data set. So we feel like in terms of quality and depth, it hits that mark. So in terms of what I was talking about in the TEDx is the top four drivers of happiness. So I'll just share two of them for this podcast, which is why the one that is the number one driver, but also the one that is the place to start. And there's a difference here. So the number one driver of happiness in our work and most studies that you look at shows that relationships is the number one driver of happiness. And that's what I was talking about in that TEDx talk. But what I was also talking about in that TEDx talk is that we wear this suit, what I call the super happiness suit, where at work, where we pretend everything's okay all the time, even if everything's in chaos. And why I talk about that is because unless people actually really share, they don't actually form a real relationship. They form basically a fair weather relationship that is strong when things are going well. But the minute you hit some rocky roads, you never actually really knew that person because they were showing you a different person to who they are.
Yeah.
So your relationships is number one driver, but the place to start, I believe from the work that we do, which is still in the top four, although it's not the number one, it's still top four, I still believe the place to start on any project is psychological safety, because that's the first thing any company should be doing when they onboard someone, when they've got people that have been there for 15 years, is make someone feel safe. Because the minute you don't feel safe, your body and your brain is diverting resources to keep you safe, which means you're not doing all the other stuff. You're not accessing the parts of the brain where things like creativity sit. So if your employees feel fearful, you are not getting the best of them. So I think the starting point is psychological safety. And when people feel safe, they'll share more and then you can build more authentic relationships.
Build more authentic relationships. Yeah, because I guess if you don't have psychological safety, you are wearing the super happiness suit. You're not actually sharing or kind of giving anybody an idea of how you really feel or what's really going on for you.
Exactly that. Exactly.
That makes that impossible.
Yeah.
So what do companies do? How, from a psychological safety point of view, what are people doing in order to help build that up? and make people feel safe in the workplace?
So there's no big secret here other than to ask people and talk about it. Now, the challenge with that in any organization comes power dynamics. So most surveys at the Happiness Index we send out of our customers are anonymous. Now, the problem is with a lot of surveys is if you do them yourself, the employees fear that really, and companies don't like to admit this, but they wonder if, and everyone's done this, I've done this when I worked somewhere else, you think, oh, who's really seeing my results? Who's going to know? That's what happens, isn't it?
You get afraid to actually say what you really think in case it can be pinned to you.
Yeah, which comes back to psychological safety, because if you felt 100% safe, you would just say, because you like, and that's what families do, isn't it? Like you mentioned your husband, like they just share information outwardly because they feel safe, don't they? So like sometimes it's your family members or your closest people that will say the things that hurt you most, but sometimes that's because that's the truth and nobody else is prepared to share that with you, because even if you don't see your family again, they can't fire you. Even if you don't want to speak to your brother again and you never see each other again, you can't be fired as someone's brother or sister or whatever. So there's an element within a family that is good and bad that brings that out. But in an organization, there's a power dynamic where people are getting paid. So no matter how open door policy someone says, you've still got the power to stop that person being able to pay their rent or their mortgage. By removing from that organization, rightly or wrongly. So the first thing is making people feel safe to fill out surveys. And then when you get the data, actually listening to it, because I've written an article about like the elephants in the room of employee engagement. And the first one is you get the data back, you sit down with a CEO and they don't believe it. They don't believe the data.
Oh my God. Yeah, I can imagine.
And then they say, because the reality is, the higher you up are in an organization, the more filtered the view is that you've got. And also your perspective is different. If you're standing on a mountain, and I know you're at the bottom of a mountain at the moment, Alison, we're not talking theoretically.
From a physical location point of view.
Physically. If I was to go to that mountain, or your husband's to go to that mountain that you're at the bottom of, you would see the world differently. And that's the same in an organization with data. So data of the employees often is different to what a CEO sees. Secondly, there is then, because I basically spend my time telling people information that they don't necessarily want to hear. That's my life.
Yeah.
And the professor who did the financial study earlier did a really good talk about how when you show someone data that confirms what they believe, hormones are sent out in their body that makes them feel good. When you show someone information that contradicts what they believe, hormones sent out in their body that make them feel not great. I'm oversimplifying how.
Yeah, but no, it makes total sense.
But to get the point is, CEOs are often seeing data that they don't believe to be true. So at this point, you've got two options. You can lean into it and own it, or you can ignore it. And there is a huge tendency for people to ignore it. It's a natural thing. If I ignore it, it will go away. However, sometimes people will say to us, well, yeah, I don't really want to talk about this at the company update because it's gonna make it worse. And then through a process of having a strong relationship with a customer or someone that's looking at data, you have to kind of politely say, but everyone already knows this.
Yeah, not going to be a surprise. And that actually the vulnerability in sharing is going to build trust.
And
it's counterintuitive, but
And normally the only person who didn't know this was the CEO.
Yeah, so because people are only telling them what they want to hear.
Yeah, so you've got to give
actually the truth.
You've got to give the leaders room to process that information, because that's where lots of them, they go first, well, let's not tell anyone. It's like politely saying, well, they already know. So that's like saying to me, not telling me where London is. I already know where London is. I live there. So
yeah,
you can kind of that.
Well,
that
actually, by not saying it, you're actually saying it. What it communicates is you don't care.
Yeah.
Well, that's how people will perceive it if they've taken the time to give the feedback and be open about it, and then nothing's ever acknowledged. I have certainly had this experience in past jobs myself years ago, where you fill out the engagement survey, and then nothing ever happens ever again. You just hear nothing about it.
And you'll be shocked. You'll be shocked when a leader takes the opportunity to acknowledge it and say, "This is what you've said. It's not great. These are things that we can fix. These are things we're not." You'd be shocked at how much kudos that leader then gets from the employee workforce, because they're like, you almost can see it in the data. When someone's like, "Oh, like finally, people are listening to me." Like, it has this really good impact on the organization. But often the leaders fear that the opposite will happen, when actually, generally that I've never seen that happen. Generally, what happens? People go,
"No,
thank you for listening. I appreciate it."
Well, there's so much research. I don't know, like Brené Brown's done a whole load of this stuff all around vulnerability in leadership. And she's amazing. And again, it's data led, so it's scientifically proven, and it's a quality that the best leaders have. But it feels a lot just don't want to step into it, because you don't want to be vulnerable. You don't want to admit that maybe you're not the best at something, or that something is wrong, or something's not working.
Yeah.
But it does. And like when leaders are like that, typically the people that are working for them or within their organizations are like, "Oh, okay." It kind of builds trust. It builds loyalty. Yeah. It makes them feel like a human being, which engenders much more positive emotions. Like, going back to that link where happiness is linked to the emotional side of things and how you feel.
Yes.
It can only be good in the long run.
Absolutely. But we're all, as our head of neuroscience, Clive, always said, we've all got an ego, every single one of us, every listener, me and Alison.
Mm-hmm.
We've all got an ego, and sometimes it rubs up against that. And that's where you got to kind of like, that's why you got to give people time to process, because your first instinct might be to ignore it. But if you actually let it sink in and think about it over a period of time, you should get to the conclusion, right, let's do something about this. And the other thing that I always say to leaders, I always ask them a question that I'm hoping that they're going to answer it. I always say to them, "Are you breaking child labor laws?" And you hope they say, "No, I'm not breaking child labor laws." But when I ask the question, they think, "Oh God, what's this crazy guy talking about?" But the way that I think leaders have got to look at it, unless you're breaking child labor laws, every single one of your employees is an adult. So every problem that is surfaced, they're already dealing with in their own life. These are not special things. We're not special as leaders of businesses. All the challenges around the budget, sales, mental health issues, comms issues, every family is dealing with these same issues. Like, can we afford to do this month? Oh, I've fallen out with that person. My family member is struggling with their mental health. How do we balance the budgets? A company is just all of those problems, just on a larger scale. So if you go back to your employees and say, "These are the problems," these are not like special leader subjects that they're not going to understand. We're not leaders are not that amazing. They're not dealing in this like invented world up here. They're dealing with normal things that everyone will understand. And obviously you get technical stuff that might happen in an organization, but that's different. The most of the problems you're dealing with are human issues that everyone understands. And once you start talking about it, you can start fixing it.
Yeah, I love that. That is so true. So say an organization builds this, it builds psychological safety, so that people feel like they can share how they really feel within surveys. And then those business leaders vulnerably listen to that, sit with the discomfort and start to put things in place or introduce things or stop things that help that. That then gives employees or helps employees feel like they can be honest about how they feel. And I just wanted to touch on this, because I think a lot of the time when we think about emotions and how we feel, it's like, well, that's not the place for that is not work. So how do companies deal with that? Or how should employees think about that? You know, from a, like, how much do you choose to share? If the whole idea is what really leads happiness is relationships and positive relationships. And in order to do that, you've kind of got to share and, you know, feel safe sharing with people to build those relationships. How much should people be sharing or not? Or like, is there any guidance on that?
So you mentioned Brené Brown earlier, and I think if I took and I'd recommend everyone to read Atlas of the Heart. It's a great book that Brené Brown's written. If you take her book, which is about emotions, and you take my book, which is called The Happiness Index, Why Today's Emotions Equals Tomorrow's Performance, you take the two bodies of work and combine them. Brené wouldn't say this, but if you combine the two, what I would say is emotions are data points. So emotion is just your body telling you something. So fear, disgust, contempt, jealousy, happiness, they're your body telling you something. And again, you've got two choices. You can either listen or ignore. Now, if you take, for example, any emotion that you may have felt, we did a really interesting webinar on the difference between jealousy and envy. Now, let's say you feel negative emotions towards one of your colleagues. And again, Alison, you might may touch on these in your private sessions with your clients. Let's dig into that. Okay, am I jealous or am I envious? Do I know the difference? I didn't know until I researched for that podcast webinar we did the difference. And I think generally from my reading, what I learned about the difference is envy is something you can use positively. Jealousy is something you can use negatively. So say someone in your team gets promoted and you don't, you become envious and you go, no, I think Alison's done a brilliant job. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go and have a coffee with her and I'm going to try and replicate it. Jealousy would be, Alison's been promoted. I can't stand her now. I don't want to speak to her. I want to bring her down. So that I'm just using a really simple example, but just thinking of them as data points. You're just thinking, what's my body telling me here? And it might be need some work you need to do. You might need to look up Alison and do some work yourself. It might be telling you something really, it might be telling you that actually, no, your boss is toxic. They don't want the best for you. They are trying to hold you down for your next career opportunity. And that fear is actually coming from some real data. Could be coming from the fact that you went through a traumatic experience a few years ago and now you're bringing that experience into the new experience. I don't know the answer to all of this, but what I would say is the way to bring it to the workforce is not see it as like the crazy stuff that happens. See it just like any data point. And think about it also from a customer perspective. If your customer is unhappy, you'd want to know. You would want to know. Yeah. People tend to fix it quicker because if you're running a restaurant, customers are not liking the food, people don't come back, restaurant shuts down. It's quicker.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Alison, I know we're coming towards the end now. Unfortunately, and I hate to use this analogy, bad customer service is like getting a slap in the face. It's immediately painful and not good to experience. Bad culture is like a slow cancer that kills an organization over time. So you can't necessarily see it happening all the time. So that's why I'd encourage people to see them as data points, because there may be data points across a whole organization that is saying that some group or something in the culture is toxic. And unless you remove that, it's actually going to kill the organization. Look at all those big scandals like Enron and so on. There would have been a culture within there of where people are doing things that they shouldn't do and people are not making people accountable for that, which results in this big financial disaster. But that will have started as a cultural issue at the beginning. So I would say think of that emotions as data points and we call the happiness index, not the high happiness index. We're not advocating for high levels. You can't be happy all the time. What you're doing is just learning. And if you feel unhappy, don't think, oh God, this is really bad, I'm unhappy. Think, use it as a data point. Think, why am I unhappy?
Yeah.
And then analyze it and use it to plot forward.
Break it down. I love that. It's a really, really sensible way of looking at it. And I've never really thought about emotions as data points, but you're absolutely right. Just in terms of it is our bodies telling us something one way or another.
Yeah.
Analyzing what that really means and what the heart of it is and whether it's positive or negative can help you make the right choices about whether you are in a toxic environment and it's worth moving, or actually this is my own emotional shit going on here and there's a different way I can approach it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I suppose just to end, like for you, like within your, I mean, obviously you're the co-CEO of a company and you've got various other things going on, but what, like, what do you need to make you happy?
Yeah, that's a good one. One of mine is in the top four. Mm-hmm. I think I take relationships and psychological safety for granted. I remind myself mm-hmm. of that because I'm in my own organization where I can, at a very simple level, that bit of it is kind of a bit more in my control than if you're an employee. Yeah. And I mm-hmm. work with lots of people that I've only known for 6 months, but I also work with lots of people I've known for 15 years across two different businesses. So I'm working with people that I really respect and enjoy working with. So I feel like that relationship's yeah. I feel really privileged and I have to remind myself not to take for granted. But the one that is in the top four, which I haven't talked about at the moment, is freedom. So for me, freedom is, could me and Alison come up with an idea for the Happiness Index tomorrow? Could I go and test it and try it? And if it's a failure, I'm not going to get fired. So freedom and psychological safety are almost different ends of a spectrum. But for me, that's why I'm an entrepreneur. I never found a corporate culture where I felt that I had freedom. And some people might not put freedom as high up in their thing, and they may put relationships higher, which is why they may prefer to work in a different type of organization where there's lots of people and all this kind of stuff. And we all come to it with our own baggage. But for me, freedom is the zenith. But I think it also comes from a privilege. You often find people that have been treated badly might put psychological safety high. So if someone's worked for a manager that doesn't trust them and micromanages them, you often find that they put psychological safety. Like if I'm in a room and I say, and then we can do this, I can't see them, but the listeners, you say, of these three, psychological safety, relationships and freedom, which one do you put the highest?
Yeah.
When people say psychological safety, then if you get chatting to them, there's often a story behind why they've put that. So that's what I mean by a bit of privilege, because I feel safe. It's like Maslow hierarchy of needs. I can focus on freedom. But if I didn't have safety, I probably wouldn't be thinking about
it. Yeah, that probably wouldn't be thinking, okay, yeah, that makes total sense. And I think we share this, actually, because freedom is my top value and it is the thing that drives me more than anything, I think, you know. But that's because relationships and psychological safety are a given for me. So.
And I think we both identify as O'Leary's, don't we? So
we do. We do.
I'm a feeling, but my mother is an O'Leary and I identify as an O'Leary, not as a feeling. So I think there's an O'Leary thing in that.
The Irish blood.
My family.
So just for listeners, because you said there were four things. So we talked about psychological safety, freedom, relationships. What's the fourth thing? Just to end.
If you'd asked me 5 minutes ago, I wouldn't have remembered. I was struggling to remember all four of them. But it did pop into my head. The fourth one is acknowledgement.
Oh, okay.
Acknowledgement. I'll give you one last takeaway on acknowledgement. Acknowledgement has the highest standard deviation of the top four. What that means is if it was a team of 10 people, what they'd want from acknowledgement would vary more than what they would want from safety and relationships. So, that's why you often see companies get it wrong. And a good example, I always use this mistake that I shared, is our CTO, when they upgraded the platform, I gave them the Happiness Index platform, the technology, I gave that CTO a public shout out of acknowledgement and he hated it and really didn't like it. I've worked with this guy for 15 years. I know if I thought about it, I would have known that and I've even got the data on it, but I'm still getting it wrong. And what the reason I use that example is because even though I knew the data and I knew the individual, I still got it wrong. What I should have done is taken him for a coffee and said, no, I really appreciate what you've done. But the reason I share that story of my failure is that we all do it. People tend to manage how they would like to be managed. Rather than just actually ask people, like, what I would get those four.
What works for you?
I would get those four and I'd ask your team, if you're listed now, I'd write them down. I'm going to test Alison. Can you remember the four, Alison? Can you remember them? I can.
Psychological safety, positive relationships, acknowledgement, and freedom.
So, Alison's good at her active listening. That's good. write those four down. Scroll, wind back if you listen to Alison say those four. Write them down, then get your team to rank the number one. And I guarantee you, if you're in a team of more than four or five people, they will rank them in different orders. And the conversation about why they've ranked them in different orders will tell you a lot about your team. And you'll find it easier to be happier at work if you do that together.
Amazing. That's a great place to end. Listen, Matt, thank you so much. It's been fabulous having you on the show. Thanks so much for sharing so much insight from all of your data and your own personal experiences. If anyone's interested in learning more about the Happiness Index or your podcast, or maybe want to hire you as a keynote speaker or a consultant, where can they find you?
Yeah, so the easiest place is add me on LinkedIn, and then you can go to the Happiness Index. It's thehappinessindex.com. You can find out about, we've got the platform that measures. We've got a product called Action, which helps you turn the data into action plans. We've got Thrive, which is an L&D product, which allows you to train people on the things that Alison's very good at, active listening. If you don't have an active listening team, you can't deliver high performance. And then the final bit that is called Perform, which is how you build that model to show that your culture is turning into performance. But then if you want to book me as a keynote speaker, go to mattphelan.co.uk. But everyone thinks that Phelan is spelled with an F, but it's P-H-E-L-E-N.
Don't worry, I will put all the links in the show notes so that people can find you.
Yeah, but if you've got a random question about today, message it to me. I love, the more random a question, the more I enjoy answering it.
There you are, there's an invite. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks so much for joining us. And I really hope that it's given you some new ideas on happiness at work and potentially a resource to share with your HR or leadership team if your company really is in need of some help with improvement or on engagement and happiness. If you know anyone who would benefit from listening to this conversation and Matt's brilliant insights, please do share this episode. And until next time, just know that I believe in you and your ability to identify and go after your own unique happiness markers, you know, whether that's in a work or personal context. So go do your thing.
Thank you for listening today. I hope our time together has got you thinking about your own adventure in happiness. So please do get in touch. I'd love to hear more about your story. And why not join our Dream Chasers Unite community? There is nothing better than an adventure shared. Until next time, be brave and go create what you crave.